Welcome to Earth Matters, environmental justice stories from so-called Australia and around the world. Produced at the studios of 3CR on Wurundjeri Woiwurrung country in Naarm, Melbourne, and broadcast across the continent via the Community Radio Network. I pay my respects to elders past and present of the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung and of the many lands our content reaches. I recognise that sovereignty has never been ceded, and I affirm that there can be no environmental justice without justice for First Nations peoples across the globe. I'm Mia Audrey.
Actually, there's kind of a world that's beneath our notice that ought not beneath our notice. And scientists find that all the time. And I think poets are often looking for that too.
On this show, I bring you interviews with two poets whose recent works chronicle deepening relationships with our living world. Yoonjidup is a work of poetry and narrative non-fiction recounting Giles Watson's relationship with a freshwater wetland during a long, dry summer. Vampire Squid is a close and personal account of the deep sea and the people who study it. Written throughout Premier Arasu's time working at the University of Western Australia's Deep Sea Research Centre. In both, you hear the depth of curiosity and passion these poets bring to their interactions with the more-than-human world. You also hear about community conservation efforts, chronic illness, scientific debates, pop culture, First Nations ecological knowledge, potato farming, and a whole lot more. First up, here's Prema Arasu on their book Vampire Squid. Prema, thank you so much for coming on the show. Some of our listeners wouldn't have heard about the vampire squid at all. Can you share a little bit about this strange creature and why you chose it as your book's namesake?
Yes, so the vampire squid is my favourite animal. It's not a squid and it's not quite an octopus either. It is about the size of a football. It's deep red and it's named vampire squid because its arms are connected by this red cloak that makes it look like a vampire. So it doesn't eat blood. It actually eats poo by trailing its tentacles. So it has 10 arms and two tentacles, really long tentacles that it drags through the water. And these tentacles pick up what's called marine snow, which is a nice name for fragments of mostly poo and very small animals and fragments of other animals that drift through the sea. So it's a filter feeder. And it has these two fins, which kind of look like ears, but they're fins that it uses for locomotion. It lives in the twilight zone, which means it's 200 metres to about 1,000 metres. It's been observed at those depths where the pressure is quite high, so it moves very slowly. It equalises its internal body pressure to the outside water to survive that pressure differential. And it has this defence mechanism where it turns itself inside out to reveal these spines, and it also can release bioluminescent ink to sort of jet away, spray whatever's threatening it and get away. So it sounds intimidating, but really it's just a scared little creature, I think. So that paired along with its nonconformity to taxonomy inspired me to write the vampire squid sequence of poems, which are the most meaningful to me. They're the most personal and the most vulnerable. And that was emerged as the poem which I should name my collection after.
Yeah, okay, wonderful. Sounds like almost an alien, right, to us, and a lot of what goes on in the deep sea is very alien to those of us who live very far from these depths that you're talking about. What have you noticed about the stories that we tell about the deep sea? How is it conceptualized within Western institutions and pop culture from what you've observed?
So it's exactly that. It's a lot of othering. It's a lot of alien. But if we were to go to the deep sea with our skin and hair and whatever equipment we'd need to observe these creatures, they'd think we are aliens, and we would be technically alien to that environment because we're not adapted. So I'm questioning and sometimes resisting that narrative of othering. and trying to think of creatures as simply the way they are because they're adapted to where they live, and I want to try and find the connections between us, because we most likely life originated in the oceans, and I want to think back and remind people of those connections and make the deep sea feel like home. In popular culture, as you said, and this includes like movies like The Meg, those kind of trashy like deep exploitation movies, but also science communication documentaries, like very well regarded documentaries, YouTube videos tend to perpetuate the same rhetoric of alien, other, scary, mysterious, and that can be quite appealing, but it's not necessarily true in any empirical way, and it does fascinate us, but it's not quite conducive to getting us to care about these creatures in the way that they actually really need us to care about them right now. The deep sea is the world's biggest ecosystem, and this othering, this alienization of it, makes us think that it's somehow resilient to human impact. It's not. Right. It's full of plastic. So when scientists observe the seafloor for the first time, so parts of the seafloor that have never been observed, they find that it's absolutely littered with ocean plastic that has drifted there from like river ecosystems and from oceanic dumping as well. It's somewhat of a heat sink for ocean, rising open ocean temperatures, but that has a limit on it as well. So we need to expand our effective care of the oceans to all of its depths and think past coastlines and pretty coral reefs.
Yeah, I mean, you've certainly bitten off a lot as somebody trying to be somewhat of a champion for this part of the world that is out of sight to us, that is othered and alienated. It's an impressive undertaking, and I know that part of what it involved was working alongside a lot of scientists, but yourself being someone whose work is in the humanities and hence the poetry. How did you find that experience of working with people who come from quite a different set of disciplines to you?
Yeah, so it was absolutely fascinating. So I worked for the I've worked for the Mindaroo UWA Deep Sea Research Centre, and the team structure is very forward-thinking and very progressive in that it's multidisciplinary. So in that team, a few of the scientists we have were, we have like worm taxonomists, we have geoscientists, oceanographers, geneticists, and there's lots of collaborations with other deep sea groups. And also when there's field work in a certain area, there's collaboration with, say, the indigenous people of those Pacific islands, or Japanese scientists who were working in Japanese waters and so on. Mm-hmm. So I guess what's even more radical than usual is the inclusion of a humanities scholar. And the director of the center, Professor Alan Jamieson, at the time I was hired, just started his podcast called the Deep Sea Podcast, which is an absolutely fantastic podcast I would highly recommend. He was dealing with frustration of this rhetoric, continued rhetoric of the deep sea, everyone talking about how it's alien, everyone talking about this must be filled with undiscovered monsters, and deciding that he will fund research, dedicated research from within his multidisciplinary team to work with the rest. And I think I picked it up. I really ran with it, and curiosity and exploration was really encouraged.
It sounds like a bit of an uphill battle for folks who are in this space. It sounds like the folks that you're meeting are almost have a warrior mentality about it, or a prophet in the wilderness kind of. I'm wondering, what's the emotional experience like? Do you get to share some of that frustration, and is there grief in the mix? I mean, obviously there's a lot of different feelings that come through your book of poems. Can you speak a little to that emotional journey of getting to know the deep sea and the way that it is almost villainized?
Yeah, so I think actually along the course of the 3 or 4 years now that I've been working on this, it has actually changed. The deep sea has garnered a lot more attention. These calls for changing the way we speak about it have actually reached science communicators at a global level. But yes, it is also, poetry is immensely personal, and you can't remove the self from the writing of poetry. So I embrace that subjectivity in my observations of the scientists. I express my insecurity about being a humanities researcher in a science centre, and using science funding, precious science funding, to write my poetry. And I integrate that into my poetry as well through the metaphor of the vampire squid. So I'll read my poem written during a Monday meeting. And this poem is also a good insight into the praxis of writing poetry that I had, which was literally working with everyone and sometimes writing poems as things happened during our meetings. 908 in G34. The team is here with keep cups of coffee and notebooks and pens. The marine biologist has two fish in the minus 80 freezer down the hall. The geneticist has a test back from the lab, and the results will shock you. They're the same species. She knows this because there is almost no difference in the sequence of their barcoding protein. A heated discussion ensues. How can these be the same one when one is big and transparent blue and the other is pinkish and gelatinous with a black stomach for hiding its bioluminescent prey? But the nucleotides do not lie. What is a species even, says the ecologist, who is prone to philosophical musings. It depends, says the geneticist. I start talking about Haraway and multi-species ethnographies and wet ontologies and teleology and get looks from everyone. Monday morning is not the time for phenomenology.
That's amazing. Thank you so much for sharing. I love the humor in there. I'm a big Haraway fan, so that reference will never go astray. And yeah, great little window into the complexity that the experience was of being a poet among scientists like that. Really appreciate you sharing that experience in your book, and I really appreciate you coming on the show to talk about it as well.
No worries. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
That was Prema Arasu of the University of Western Australia's Deep Sea Research Centre on the interplay of personalities and academic disciplines within their research team, chronicled in their book Vampire Squid. You're listening to Earth Matters, Community Radio's National Environmental Justice Program. We're hearing from poets who explore place and nature connection through their work alongside scientists. Next up, Giles Watson shares about his journey getting to know and care for Yunjidup, a wetland near his home in so-called Western Australia. Giles, thank you so much for coming on the show. We're talking about your book Yunjidup, which is a book chronicling your relationship with a beautiful freshwater wetland in so-called Western Australia. Can you tell us a little bit about this special place?
Yeah, well, Yunjidup is very close to the sea, but it is a freshwater wetlands. And it's tucked in behind a little hamlet called Young Siding, which is between Albany and Denmark, just a little string of houses along the road. Mm-hmm. And nobody would know it was there unless they were told about it. Its water comes from wild spaces in an area called Lowlands. And that filters through Yunjidup, which kind of purifies the water. And it makes its way then via various streams into Wilson Inlet and out into the ocean. And it was, for quite a bit of last century and going into our century, was a potato farm. The farmer would dig drainage channels to release the water more rapidly and would grow potatoes in the alluvial soil there. But there came a time when the reeds or the reed mace was growing so much that he was having difficulty getting his tractor in there, and eventually he gave up. And a few years after that, people started hearing bitterns booming at night. Their mating call is a really, really deep resonant boom. And the Australasian bittern is an endangered species. So that kind of alerted people to the fact that this is a very special place in terms of its biodiversity. And the first time I went there, I realized that straight away, because I was walking on a little road that goes between two of the big lakes that form the wetlands, and there was water all over that road. Mm. And there were tadpoles swimming around in it, and in front of me in the air there were damselflies and dragonflies everywhere, and this kind of tapestry of birdsong. And I just thought, oh wow, this is a really, really special place.
Yeah, it sounds like it. And special also in that it's not an untouched wilderness. I mean, it has an interesting story, which it is birthed from this complex interaction between humans and the world we live in. I really appreciate that your book captures that. It's not a story of pristine, untouched wilderness. It is a story about all the different ways that people have and continue to shape this place in harmful ways, in protective ways. I'm curious about your role in the mix of that. What role do you see yourself as having in the Yunjinup ecosystem?
Yeah, well, since people have heard that bittern, there's been a movement to save this place. And that took the form of BirdLife Australia and the Wilson Inlet Catchment Committee and the local Denmark Bird Group getting together to raise public funds to actually buy the whole place. And that was successful. I donated a bit of money to that, and I volunteered for some seed collecting where we got seeds from one part of the wetland, which was had natural vegetation with the view to then growing that and replanting it in a place which had been degraded. But I think really my main role is actually just to be Yunjinup's poet, which is like a really old-fashioned idea, but it means I'm kind of engaged in acts of noticing what is there, and even the very, very small things, kind of getting eye to eye with things, getting eye to eye with the damselfly. And so I think that my role has been through this book to give the place a kind of voice that can be heard by human beings, but also to make people aware that this kind of thing can be done. You know, we live in an age where we get so much bad news about the environment, but like, here's good news. This place is burgeoning with life.
Yeah, oh, that's beautiful. I am curious too about, as a storyteller of this place, how much of you engaged with the long history of storytelling that I'm sure exists there, as everywhere. How much of you engaged with the First Peoples, the Noongar people of the Yunjinup ecosystem?
Yeah, well, I actually engaged most of all with Auntie Carol Pettersen, who is a local Noongar elder at another wildlife site called Red Mort, which is a more inland space. And she was teaching me and a group of my students about the Noongar seasons. And just through her teaching, I was realizing, you know, the wisdom there is extraordinary, that our seasons that we impose on this place really don't make that much sense of the changes that happen. And everything that she was saying to me, I gradually started applying to what I was seeing at Yunjinup in terms of the way that place was changing as the weather got hotter and drier. So I think it was the major way that I was affected by talking to local Noongar people. And that's still a process with me. I think in some ways I feel I'm just at the beginning of that process after having been in Britain for 18 years. Sure. And the book is partly about me kind of finding my way, still feeling like a bit of an imposter on land that isn't mine, finding a way to relate to it and realizing that in order to do that, I not only need to pay attention to the place, which I suppose I've been trained to do in the past, but pay attention to that knowledge which pre-exists me by tens of thousands of years.
Yeah, I think it's really powerful to have an example of a settler colonizer grappling with what it looks like to connect to place, to explore place, given that we are on stolen land. The other thing that's really interesting about your journey is you do interweave that experience of connecting with Yunjinup with your experience with chronic illness and diagnoses. Can we hear a little bit about how that's gone along the way?
Yeah, well, because I was at Yunjinup during the increasingly hot months of the year, it was drying up as I was there. And in fact, since it's been purchased, the Wilson Inlet Catchment Committee has taken steps to retain a lot of the water in summertime so that it's protected in view of future climate change, that it will still retain water and be a place that birds can come to. But when I was there during the really, really hot months, the water shrunk to very, very small areas of open water, and the birds were congregating there. It was really quite extreme. And with my illness, which was diagnosed at the time as chronic fatigue, but has now been narrowed down to fibromyalgia, and also during the course of the book, I was diagnosed with sleep apnea. One of the symptoms at nighttime is that I would have very interrupted sleep, and I'd wake up at night with my mouth and my throat absolutely parched. And so that idea of dryness and of being unwell, I suppose, fitted both the environment and what I was experiencing in my own life. And so that becomes a kind of strain that runs throughout the whole text. Yeah. But I think it's really important to emphasize too, like, it's not a nature cure narrative. It's not some heroic tale of how I went into this place and got cured by it. Yinjidup didn't cure me, but it did give me a reason for being, a reason to keep my senses alert, reason to keep engaging with what was around me, even when I had no energy. I think that might have a message for loads of people that, you know, we can still do that no matter how ill or fatigued or disabled we may be. There are spaces where we can sit and be and observe.
Absolutely. And I think there's an important message too around dissolving the boundaries between ourselves and so-called nature, between ourselves and these life support systems. It's so powerful as a poet to come in with this experience where your body is mirroring what's going on in the landscape around you. And also there's a mutual healing that you're feeling, the environment helping to heal you, but also you're helping to heal this part of nature that's been harmed. The other boundary that I see challenged in your work is between art and science. Can you tell a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I liked what you just said too about life support systems. And I wonder whether the role of a poet between kind of art and science is partly kind of testifying about how the natural world is our life support system. But just before I started talking to you today, I was reading a poem with my literature class, a 19th century poem by John Clare called Remembrances. And it's a poem about his own ecological grief, about places that he loved that have been destroyed through so-called progress. And I think there's actually a long tradition of writers and artists who are observers informed by science, but writing in poetry or writing in prose. And I think I was consciously writing in that tradition. Which is helped by the fact that I was brought up in a household where my dad was a research scientist and my mum was an English teacher. So I was always between those two worlds and being encouraged to read poems and to emulate them, but also having leading scientists around for dinner, having really what seemed to me quite abstract conversations. But I think just growing up in that environment kind of led me to that place where, you know, if I see something wild, I want to go a little deeper. I want to try to see it from its own level. There's a passage where I go back in time to describe my father showing me pond water through a microscope. And the passages in the book for a really good reason. I think it's because that was a moment where I thought, oh, wow, actually there's kind of a world that's beneath our notice that ought not to be beneath our notice. And scientists find that all the time. And I think poets are often looking for that too.
Absolutely. Oh, it's so stunning to hear more about it. I'm wondering, just in the last little bit of time that we have left, would you share a small passage or a poem with us?
Yeah, sure. So I'll share the poem, which is right at the center of the book and of its narrative, really. So I mentioned the Australasian bittern. I was looking for this bird while I was there. It was becoming quite an obsession, as I think it does for a lot of people. And they're very hard to find, right, because they've got a striated pattern, they're perfectly camouflaged, they stand with their beak kind of pointing up into the sky, and they sway with the reeds and they just disappear. You can be looking straight at them and not notice them. But I did see one. It had come out from the wetlands and it was fishing from a little puddle of water where lots of fish had been captured as the stream had evaporated. And so this is about my seeing that bird. It's called Australasian bittern. Cryptic bittern, living puzzle, breath of moonlight, hidden riddle, conundrum on extinction's edge, lurking by a concrete bridge. I didn't mean to fright you, bittern, or interrupt your patient fishing. I'll wait a lifetime here to glimpse you, muddy mottled glyph of wishing. I hope, bittern, I can find you, find and leave you undisturbed, to behold but not to solve you, ancient, noble, fleeting bird. Teach me, bittern, how to tell a world which drains and looks away, how to halt, behold you, bittern, so you linger, never fly. Lend me breath of booming, bittern, so that I might cast a spell of mottled umbers wet and seeping, deliverance from concrete hell. Take me to your reed bed, bittern, let me sway as reed stems do. Teach me arts of disappearing and treading lightly, light as you.
Beautiful. Thank you so much, Giles. I really appreciate you coming on the show and sharing your wisdom with us. Thanks so much.
Thanks very much.
Giles Watson, a poet as scientist based in Western Australia, on his encounters with Australasian bitterns in the Yoongidup wetland. You've been listening to Earth Matters, Community Radio's National Environmental Justice Program. I'm Mia Audrey. We've heard from two poets based in Western Australia whose recent works explore the interplay between art and science and between people and nature. To secure a copy of their works, visit the Fremantle Press website. I'll provide a link in the show notes to this episode at 3cr.org.au/earthmatters. Thanks for listening. That's all for now. But tune in next week for more environmental justice stories. Earth Matters would like to thank the Community Broadcasting Foundation for their financial support and the Community Radio Network for getting the program out to you. Earth Matters is produced in the studios of 3CR, NAM, Melbourne.